You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where I'm not going to do some absurd witty opening because I don't feel like it. What do I feel like? My answer to that question may surprise some of you because people who hold my beliefs and have my personality are often seen as, at best, callous and at worst, hateful. But really, I'm heavy. Why? Because deep down, I'm so full of love that I'll never be able to understand how someone can even think of killing people they disagree with. Sure, I'll call Devin Farsi a huge fucking asshole, but it would never cross my mind to even wish violent harm upon him, let alone walk into his place of business or pleasure and harm him myself. Often, people claim love is the only response to such hateful attacks as the one in Orlando this past Saturday night. To them, that means turning the other cheek or forgiving. That is not love. Love is acknowledging the deep sorrow you feel at the loss of or threat to the value you hold so highly, and doing what is necessary to honor or protect that value going forward. If you treat a person or people who hate the thing you love the same exact way that you treat the thing you love, you're not responding with love at all. You're responding with indifference. Loving someone or something is not just a state of mind. It is a state of action. And if your response to those people who take action against what you love is to do nothing, then you've stated that what you love is no better than those people who hate what you love. And that's not love at all. Joining me this week via Skype from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. That's how I'm feeling, Daniel. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling a strange sense of, I don't know, detachment, maybe is the word, but not because I feel personally detached, but it's things where it's like, every time after the kind of incidents like the one in Orlando, I expect to go into work or group where any mass number of people are congregating, and I expect us to sort of all acknowledge this thing and have some sort of group catharsis. And it has not happened since 9/11. Like, today was any other day at work. There were a couple kind of small passing comments about the thing, but really there was no major in-depth discussion. And I don't know, that makes me feel weird. I know that's not a complex analysis of my emotional being, but it is what it is.
All right. I feel pretty similarly about that. Do you think it's because people are sort of jaded to all of this? Or do you think it's because they're avoiding it?
I don't know. I mean, in some sense, maybe it is because they're avoiding it, not wanting to have to think about it all the time. And there is some degree to which I can respect that, except that I don't think culturally we've confronted the issue head on. So we're going to either have to keep avoiding it or eventually deal with sort of the mass cultural delusion that becomes sociological desensitization to this crap. So I don't know.
I think part of this episode is us dealing with it head on. So maybe we can start a movement here. Also joining us this week via Skype from the hills of white privilege, James Elias. How are you feeling, James?
I really appreciate what Daniel is saying. I did notice a lot of those things as well, how it's just people are still posting jokes and stuff on Facebook. I scroll through my newsfeed on Facebook and people are posting jokes about gorillas and or people falling into gorilla pits and stupid shit like that. But I and that's surprise. And now that Daniel says it, it surprises me, but I haven't even noticed that. I am for some reason, I'm not 100% sure, just incredibly angry at this. This hit me harder emotionally than San Bernardino. Just the realization that they're just mowing us down literally in the street. And the government has shown over and over again over the last few years that it is unwilling to do anything about it. I don't know if this is particularly rational of me. I have my reasons, but I'm willing to be dissuaded of this feeling. But when I see candlelight vigils, I get even more angry. I get angry at the people doing the candlelight vigils and saying like, oh, isn't it terrible that, you know, all these people died. I get angry at them. I don't necessarily stand behind this as a philosophical, well thought out opinion, but I'm angry at this. When I view us from the point of view of our enemies, which I kind of have some level of experience doing, I see nothing but weakness. I think of the United States. I think if I put myself in the shoes of Islamic totalitarians, I see nothing but weakness in us. They are not planning our destruction. They're crying about it. And so I feel an immense, obviously, an anger towards the man who did this, an anger towards ISIS, but also some anger towards the people, you know, conducting candlelight vigils. I think we need to have an armed vigil first. And then once our enemies are dead, then we can mourn our dead. Only after that is it. It just feels like it's an insult to the memory of the victims if we mourn them before we've killed our enemies and completely made sure that they're not going to do this again. Otherwise, because I know it makes me mad, because I know all these people are going to die in vain. That's the deal here. We're not going to learn our lesson. You know, you could argue that like some good came of 9/11, even, because we learned our lesson and now we were all ready to wake up and finally face this threat, and it didn't happen. Those 3,000 people and now these 50 this weekend have died in vain. And so that's why I'm angry, and that's why I'm especially angry even at the people who are mourning the dead. Again, I don't stand behind this as like a well thought out philosophical position, but that's how I feel.
Did I ask for your philosophical position?
Well, right. I'm just telling you, exactly. I'm just telling you. I'm just following directions and telling you how I feel.
That's right.
But I need to emphasize that I did not fully think this through, and I'm willing to be dissuaded of parts of it. But that is how I feel.
You don't have to put in disclaimers. We understand you're willing to be dissuaded. It's okay.
Okay. Right. Of course. But yeah.
All right.
But still, fuck this. Like, seriously, we're not going to do a fucking thing about it. Like, as soon as I heard about this, I just loaded all my rifles in the house just to make me feel better.
Okay, just like, making sure.
Because no one else is going to be loading rifles about this.
All right, just do us a favor. Let us know if anything happens, because you've now said on air that you were loading all your rifles.
Well, I'm not going to shoot them.
Okay, just making sure.
I'm just saying in today's, them to make myself feel better.
In today's
like, no
day and age. In today's day and age. No, I get you. And while we're on the subject, I didn't want to bring this up quite right away, but your reaction is similar to the reaction I had after 9/11. And I think part of the reason you're upset more about Orlando than San Bernardino is it's sort of like we didn't learn our lesson from San Bernardino. Because my reaction when 9/11 happened, and I was a freshman in college at that point, so this was kind of like, you know, people say, wow. What's the post 9/11 world like, and, you know, how did it change people? This is how 9/11 changed me. When I saw that happen and I saw the towers come down, I said, somebody's shit is about to get fucked up. I was like, it wasn't even a question in my mind that we were just going to, like, fucking pound some country back into the Stone Age. Like, that was my immediate, like, it wasn't even anger. It was just like, who was fucking dumb enough to do that? You know what I mean? It was like somebody walked up to the biggest dude in the class and hit him in the nuts. It's like, that kid's gonna get his bones broken. But then it was just like, the guy went over, the bully went over and gave the kid an Indian burn. And I was like, really? Really? Because it took us like a week, and then there was like some bombs in some Middle East, was it Afghanistan, or was it, Where was it? Where
Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Afghanistan. One quick anecdote about that, and then we need to introduce the other caller on the line, is I had that exact same emotional reaction, Justin, and in high school I was much more of a partisan Republican than I am now. And like when Bush announced there would be a shock and awe campaign, I think those were the only three words I said for like 3 weeks. And it, shock and awe. Anyone talk about 9/11, I'd be like, shock and awe. We were on the bus when the campaign started, and I got the bus of 52 kids chanting shock and awe. And then when we learned what it really was, we were like, what the fuck was that? That was not shock and awe. That was not retaliation. Like, yeah, that was nonsense.
That's like being promised a porn with like a massive penis and you get a micro penis instead.
Yeah, exactly the same thing.
Well, do you know what shock and awe means? You know what the tactic of shock and awe refers to?
No, the ending of the prestige. I certainly did not at the time.
All it means is that you're going to fly, you're constantly going to fly planes and helicopters overhead and like kind of just, it means you're going to flex your muscles without necessarily killing anyone. That's what the shock and awe means. It means you give the enemy this sense of our devastating force. And for a long time in Iraq, I know that jet fighters would just fly over cities just to buzz them, just remind us, hey, we're here. We got these amazing pieces of technology you can't comprehend that could destroy you at any minute. But I don't want a shock and awe campaign. I want a death campaign.
Yeah, I mean, one last thing. Let's get an Adam Carolla reference in here. Something Adam Carolla says a lot, Daniel, is he has one question he judges people by. And it's, should we have dropped the bombs on Japan in World War II? And if somebody says, no, we shouldn't have, he just immediately writes that person off. And I feel like we're at one of those moments right now. I mean, when we're talking about 9/11, I wasn't, like, reacting in the idea that we should have had a shock and awe campaign. I was like, no, it's 9 a.m. By 9 p.m., our country should be wiped off the map.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted, too. I just assumed it would take a little longer. Alas, okay, come on.
Also joining us.
All right. Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse. And when we say that, we do mean not California. We mean Orlando. Elliot Rivera. And we wanted Elliot to come on this episode, even though we've been alternating weeks of him and James, because this took place at a gay club in Orlando, and it was Hispanic night. So, you know, I was fortunate that I woke up and Elliot's post was the first thing I saw, so I knew Elliot was safe. But then when I started reading more and more about it, Elliot, my first thought was, holy shit, Elliot could have been there.
Yeah. How do I feel? You know, the club that was shot up, Pulse, I've been there before. Do you know that right down the street from it is the hospital I was born at? I was born in this city. I love this city. And this fucker thought that he could come here and mow us down. That so many innocent human lives were removed from existence against their will. It is infuriating. And don't nobody talk to me about love, because I have nothing but hate. Hate for this man and for the ideology that fueled him. And the reason why I hate him so deeply and with such passion is because of how much I love my city. And I love the people here. And that people whom I've crossed paths with, people that I have known, are lying dead. I have nothing but hate for that man. And for anybody to tell me that love is the answer, that I need to understand him, that I need to be compassionate towards him, fuck you. That is all I can say about this. That's all I can honestly say.
Yeah. Well, we certainly feel you, Elliot. And we are all giving you as big a digital hug as we possibly can. Wish we were there. Wish we were in closer proximity.
For those watching the video right now, I'm actually legitimately crying. Like, I'm not even making it up.
Yeah, no, I've teared up as well. It's horrifying. So there are so many things here. Elliot has touched on one major point, the understanding the guy, the fuckface who did this. There's so many things to discuss in this. So let's reset a little bit. Let's delve into the facts. Let's give this a thorough mid-side analysis that only the four of us can. So let's start with some of the facts to catch people up. This is an article from NPR basically saying what we know as of Monday. Like, what is it are the things that we know for a fact? So let's go through a little bit of this. I'm going to start at the beginning. So one day after a depraved attack at an Orlando, Florida nightclub left 49 victims dead and 53 more wounded, investigators are working to learn more about the man they say was the lone shooter. I'm not going to name the man because it actually does anger me that he gets so much press. So we will just refer to him in this as fuckface or the shooter or whatever it is. But I'm making a conscious choice not to.
What about piece of shit because he's brown?
That's racist, and we won't abide by that here on the mid-side. I feel microaggressed. I mean, he did actual aggression, but the feeling of microaggression is equally as bad, so yeah.
Sorry, I know you're entitled to your feelings.
That's right. So we know that he was motivated by radical Islamic extremism. Those are words that maybe I wouldn't choose, or at least not in that order or in that proximity, but those are the words that are being thrown around. We know that he called into 911 and pledged his allegiance to ISIS prior to doing this. In fact, several hours prior to doing this. The actual attack started just after 2 a.m. Eastern time. An Orlando police officer who was in uniform and working at Pulse responded to shots fired. The officer exchanged fire with the attacker near the entrance. More officers arrived. A second gun battle ensued, and the gunman retreated into a bathroom. And the Pulse nightclub, which I did not find out until reading this article, actually sent out a message on its Facebook account at 2:09 a.m. that said, quote, "Everyone get out of Pulse and keep running." How fucking haunting is that? It's insane. Then, you know, there are a lot of conflicting reports about what exactly happened, but we know that at about 5 a.m., police opted to force entry into the club by using an explosive to breach the exterior. The decision was made out of concern that the more people were going to die. In that time, the shithead was in the bathroom with four or five hostages. It was during that time that the gunman had three contacts with a 911 dispatcher. Said that 12 to 15 people were in an adjacent room. And then, he was killed. I don't know exactly how he was killed. I couldn't find this information.
What I found is how he died is that the FBI, or what was it, or the police in SWAT team gear blew a hole in the cinder block wall. This is called a breaching charge. They blew a hole in the cinder block wall. They made their own door. What this does is it gives you an element of surprise over someone in a hostage situation. You suddenly blast through a door that, you know, usually in these cases, like, no one wants to be the first person through a door because, like, he's pointing a gun right at the door, ready to just blast you. So what they do is they make their own door that's an angle that surprises them. And they blew a hole in it, and it actually was unsuccessful. I from what I've read, they weren't able to make a hole like large enough to get through, so they didn't actually get through. But this crazy motherfucker charged the blowhole, the hole they made, and I think he only had his pistol. He domed one of the SWAT officers in the head. Luckily, he survived because he was wearing a helmet. And then he died in a hail of gunfire at the hole in the door. So So that is how he died by the time the SWAT team got there.
That's an incredible account. I mean, it's just insane. Yeah, I mean, the NPR article basically says there was fire and then he was killed. But it's not clear. I mean, I guess you can sort of connect the dots there, but
I don't think we know what happened in this story, because at no point during the description do they explain how 50 people could have died during this.
Right.
That is not explained.
There's a lot of missing pieces to this, which I'm sure will come out over the next few days. Other things we know.
I read something where a forensic person said they were still putting together how everyone died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they've got Dexter in there doing the blood spatter analysis right now.
Yeah. And I suspect that will take quite a while. So we know he was born in America. He's Afghani descent. His father was from Afghanistan. So let's start getting into a few of the issues here. Let's start with the obvious one, which is the perennial debate about Islam and whether or not Islam is a motivating factor in these killings, San Bernardino, 9/11, etc., or whether or not these are just bad people who do bad things. This is sort of the one argument that I actually, you know, going back to what I said at the beginning of the show, where I sort of want us to have a collective emotional response to this. This is, in fact, the one argument I just can't have anymore, because it's so draining to me every time that people make, especially on the left, but also the libertarians, and maybe we'll get some pushback from our liberty.me listeners on this point, but that they can't make the connection that Islam is a hugely motivating factor in all of these things. And that Islam per se as an ideology is something we should examine as to whether or not that is what we're fighting against. Like, just getting them to answer that basic question, like, should we look at Islam as one of the ideologies that we are at war with? They won't entertain the question. Not that they have the answer no, they won't even think about it. Have you gentlemen encountered this in your experiences?
Well, the thing I would say about this, you took me away. I was going to write something on the whiteboard here that I have. But what I would say is, I think maybe, I don't know where I read this or heard this, maybe it was Adam Carolla. Back me up, Dan, check me on that. What other religion has ever inspired people to kill people? You don't see Christians out on the streets killing people, right?
Not in the last 400 years.
Right, well, that's what I was going to say. That's what I want to go back to, is even the way the fucking Crusades have been rewritten. Who were we killing in the Crusades? Who were the Christians killing? I'm putting myself on we. I'm putting Leonidas and 300 and the Spartans on the same side of the Christians in the Crusades. Who were they killing? In the Crusades.
Do you want specifically, or do you just want to say Muslims? Because it's Muslims.
You can get as specific Muslim as you want, but the point is, it's Muslims. Don't you think it's the same fucking problem that's been going on in the history of the goddamn world? Now I'm getting angry. I'm so sick of people being like, well, it's because we tried to kill them in the Crusades, or we tried to eliminate them. No, maybe it's because we knew even back then they were going to try and fucking kill us, so we went in there and killed them first. And I'm saying we because my heritage is European.
Yeah,
it happened in 300. That's a fucking retelling of it. It happened during the Crusades. How many fucking times does this have to happen in the history of the world before we fucking wise up?
Yeah.
I disagree with that analysis. I don't think this is specifically, right now we're experiencing this as a Muslim problem. And I want to make that very clear. This is a Muslim problem. But more broadly, this is a religious problem. When man resorts to religion as his epistemology, as his means of truth, there is no debate between men. There is no such thing as rational discussion when you use faith. You cannot convince someone logically of a different faith. And when man can't resort to reason during his disagreements, there's only one other option: force. And that means guns. That means violence. That means hammers to the head. And so that is what we're facing here. This particular iteration, we're dealing with savages who happen to be Muslim. But I think During the Crusades, it was much the reverse. You had a more civilized Muslim culture that was fighting a more barbarous Western Christian culture.
That's not necessarily true, and I'll push back a little bit on that. I agree with the stuff you said at the beginning about faith and force. No argument here. But I mean, even like the most cursory reading of history, like when you look at, so I was just looking up, just doing really basic background information on religious wars and number of people killed, and like the basic stuff here, you know, Christianity, and I'm getting this from Wikipedia, so chastise me later, James, but like the beginning of the article is like, before the 11th century, no Christian had developed a doctrine whereby fighting itself might be considered a spiritually meritorious act. In fact, there's all this stuff about how they wrote explicitly how about warfare in and of itself was considered not a virtuous activity. But when does it start coming about? In the 11th through 13th centuries, the Crusades were a series of military campaigns that took place against the Muslim conquests. In fact, it was completely in response to Muslim invasions that the Crusades were fought. Now, the Crusades then were used to justify attacks on non-Muslim folks, and then you have Catholics and Protestants fighting each other. But before the 11th century, Christianity had no philosophy of warfare in terms of it would be good to kill people to spread the religion. It comes out of the necessity to defend themselves against Muslims. Now, compare this to the entry right below it, 10 lines below it, on Islam. The Muslim conquests were a military expansion on an unprecedented scale, beginning in the lifetime of Muhammad and spanning all of the centuries of Islam. In fact, it goes on to say that technically, Muslim conquests don't even consider them religious wars, because there is no such thing as a separation of church and state in the Islamic philosophy. Like, warfare is necessarily a part of the Islamic philosophy. It is inseparable from the idea of Islam. And if Muslims are supposed to perfect themselves to be like Muhammad, Muhammad is the number one war maker in Islam.
Yeah, this was a discussion you and I were having, Daniel, where I was saying, you know, somebody was telling me about Christianity over the weekend before this happened, and she was saying that the ultimate ideal of Christianity is to become more and more like Jesus. And I made the joke, so your basic deal is everyone wants to die on the cross. I was being glib, but that's in stark contrast to what you just said the ideal of Muhammad is, and being more like that prophet. And that's the point I'm trying to make. Now, I don't know if I'm not an expert on the Quran and Islam, but is there an equivalent of the Ten Commandments? Because in Christianity, there's a fucking commandment that says, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah, so there are, and like Christianity, which has passages in the Bible which can be interpreted as violent, there are contradictory passages in the Quran as well about peace and violence and war and whatever. But what's very clear is that from the very beginning of Islam, Islam was founded on the idea that violence was a legitimate means to spread the religion. Christianity, for all of its faults, and I'm not a Christian, anyone knows me knows unequivocally that that is true, but Christianity, for all of its faults, was not founded on the idea that violence is the answer. It wasn't founded on the idea that non-believers are to be converted at all costs, including their own death. This was made very concrete to me when, so my fiance was born in Pakistan, many of you know that by now, grew up Muslim, was raised Muslim, is now an atheist, but we early on in our relationship, I wanted to read more of the Quran, understand where she was coming from. We were reading it together, and I get to a passage that it translated in English was, go forth and convert non-believers. And I was reading that, and she said, what? What did you say? I said, go forth and convert non-believers. And in, I forget the specific language she was reading it. It's not Arabic. She doesn't read Arabic, but it's one of the Middle Eastern languages. Urdu, maybe? Urdu. I think it was Urdu. She said, that's not the word for convert. I said, what do you mean? She says, that word is better translates as murder. Like, they're taking
incredible
poetic license.
Wait, so the people who translated it? Yeah, the people who translated it did that?
Yes, and taking incredible poetic license to change murder to convert. Like, what the fuck? That's the poetic license we're taking to say that Islam is a religion of peace? And one other thing, and I'm being ranty here, but we're all going to be ranty a little bit, I suspect, on this show, is that I got this whole pushback on social media about how Islam means peace. And now this is the sort of George Bush nonsense, but they say literally Islam means peace. Like the word, it comes from the root word salam, which means peace. That is propaganda of the highest fucking order. Ask any Muslim in the entire world. Islam literally means, in translation, surrender. It does not mean peace. It means submission or surrender, depending on your exact translation. But it's, the idea is you must submit yourself to God. You must submit yourself to Allah. It has nothing to do with the fucking word peace. And if I hear one more goddamn person tell me that Islam literally translates to peace, I may initiate violence against them. I'm just saying.
Well, if everyone just submitted, there would be world peace.
Well, that's... Yes, that is the point of Islam, by the way.
Except, of course, you know, the nonstop spiritual warfare that any religion forces a person to wage upon oneself. You know, no having sex, you know, for fun, no, you know, drinking in the case of Islam, you know, sacrificing yourself to everything, all this stuff, all these sacrifices, you know. So, you know, peace on the in the outer world, I guess, but nonstop warfare in the inner world.
I have one last thing to say on top of what James just said and on top of my rant, which is that there was a brilliant scholar, like an academic, not like a, you know, Robert Spencer, even though I think he does good work. He's not the type of scholar I'm thinking of, but like who is explaining in a lecture once why Muslims, especially in like in the countries in the Middle East, can still talk about Islam as a religion of peace. It's because they have a different concept of violence than we have. For instance, violence to them is not believing in Allah and worshiping the Prophet Muhammad. You have initiated violence by not being Muslim. So their effort to convert you, even if it requires the death, to them is a peaceful action because they are bringing you back in alignment with what is good in the world. By resisting, you are committing violence.
Yeah, we saw this of the story of the Muslims in France, right? Where there was a woman who was Muslim and she was serving alcohol on Ramadan. So they attacked her?
Yeah. Right. She had initiated the violence by breaking the Ramadan code. Yeah, absolutely. So that's, I mean, the issue of Islam, I think, is so clear now that you have to be, I don't know if you can accidentally sort of miss it anymore. Like, just, you, I don't think you can be mistaken anymore. I think you have to close every sense available to you to evade the fact that Islam is an ideology that contributes to these attacks, and it is an ideology that we need to be at war with.
I mean, I think there's a certain level of evasion here. And you know, James and I had a private conversation about how most people evade on some level, and he's sort of coming to terms with the level of evasion. But I mean, I think we see this with the social justice warriors, with the way they go about, like, oh, it's a patriarchy and it's a rape culture and blah, blah, blah. I think people who are saying and continue to say radical Islam or Islam is not an issue are people who are just evading. And they're evading to the point that it's become a coping mechanism for them and they don't even realize it. It's just they've sort of automatized it and it's just part of their psychology at this point.
Yeah. I mean, hypocrisy, to James's point, is not, you know, a philosophical argument, but someone did point out something that I laughed at, which is that all Christians are evil because three bakers won't bake gay people cakes, but a Muslim mows down 50 people in a gay nightclub and it's a religion of peace and tolerance, and who are we to judge?
Well, yeah, that goes back to we're supposed to feel guilty because, you know, we as white Christian males are the ones who have the privilege in this society. So we the standards we fit are extra high. But that's what I'm – that's fucking – I'm just going to keep going back to my same goddamn point about the goddamn Crusades and goddamn 300 It's fucking context dropping. You're dropping the context of the history of the goddamn world. Fucking learn some world goddamn history, goddammit, goddammit.
Yes, us four white Christian males on this show. Emphasizing on the Christian part.
I'm an atheist. I know I'm defending Christianity a lot on this show, but I'm only doing it to make a point. It's like a comparative point.
I can see why you would draw the strong indication that, yeah, like, Jesus was a big pussy. Jesus said you gotta churn the... Yeah, he was. He said you gotta... I mean, and that's why we're fucking losing. Bosch Boston has this great, great cartoon of Jesus submitting before Allah, the picture of the actual historical figure Jesus with his on his hands and knees bowing down to Muhammad. And that is... And, you know, that's what happened. That's the evil of Christianity here, is that by turning the other cheek, you are willingly saying we're going to let evil win. We're going to sacrifice ourselves to the worst elements of this world. And I got to say, when I think of it this way, I realize this might kind of piss you off, Elliot, but I got to think, like, isn't this kind of like a Taggart Tunnel disaster? This is not to say that everyone in the nightclub, you know, this is far from saying that everyone in the nightclub was responsible for their own deaths here. But especially in the gay community who tends to be liberal, I gotta say, they, you know, a lot of them, again, not all of them, but a lot of them, as liberals, are going to be contributing to this closing of the eyes, this ideology that prevents us from defending ourselves.
Before
and
you respond,
the ultimate price for that.
Right. Before you respond, Elliot, I just want to clarify for the audience. The Taggart Tunnel is a scene in Atlas Shrugged where a fucking plane collapses the tunnel. A train, you know, there's a huge accident, derailment, explosion inside this tunnel. And Ayn Rand in Atlas Shrugged goes through and shows how each of the passengers on the train deserve to die because they held some sort of insanely irrational belief.
Not that they necessarily... I'm not saying that anyone in the nightclub there deserved to die, and I don't know if right. Ayn Rand was saying that about the Taggart Tunnel, but more specifically, they held ideas that led to their own destruction.
Right.
Not that they necessarily deserved it, but that there was a direct connection between the ideas they held, or not a direct connection, but a connection nonetheless between the ideas they held and the thing that ended up killing
them.
They
contributed to the culture that resulted in their death.
Right, and we could argue deserve all day. But, you know, do they deserve a
violent
death?
I mean, it's deserve
death
on some small level, not right. full dessert of right. death. But, right. I mean, there's still a relationship there. There's still a causal influence.
Right, and that's what I want to be clear about it by explaining this and picking this out. That this is the point of romanticism. She romanticized it. The people in the club likely weren't as, you know, bad or irrational as the people on the train that collapsed. You wouldn't be able to pick each part. That's the point of romantic art, is you heighten it to point that out. You're just asking, James, what level is there of the what level of poor philosophy do they hold, of poor ideas do they hold?
Yeah, I mean, I look at the fact that we haven't won a war since World War II. I'm in a very angry state right now, especially at Americans. Not even evil in the world is a fucking given. There's going to be terrible people out there. The part that I feel like it's almost I'm more mad at America on some level when I can't help but feel that, like, as a culture, we deserve this. I put myself in the position of a historian studying all this shit 1,000 years from now. You know what I would think? I would say, hey, you know what? At this fucking rate, America deserved to fall. They asked for it. They begged for it, and they got it.
Elliot, what do you think about what James said about the people in the club?
Elliot, respond to that, and then also as an addendum, do you think that this incident will open up many people's eyes? Will there be a change? I know the Phoenix LGBT group there has already endorsed Trump. I don't think that's necessarily a positive change, but it is a change, certainly. So what do you think about the future of this as well?
James is not wrong. The ideas that a lot of people, especially LGBT people, hold especially down here, unfortunately, yeah, it has led to this kind of desire to be so tolerant of everybody that it almost doesn't matter who the person is. I mean, tolerance has become its own moral ideal, independent of who people are, what ideas they hold. I will say that here in Orlando, we do have a very strange mix of LGBT people who are not necessarily as hardcore left-wing as a lot of people would believe. I mean, it's actually really funny that we have a strong gay Republican group here in Florida and gay libertarians. I think that there is a lot of different kinds of LGBT people, and a lot of them are standing up and saying, look, we need to start talking about Islam. We need to start talking about this. We have to stop blaming the guns. We have to stop blaming Christians. We have to stop, you know, blaming all these people that are not directly responsible for what has happened. I will say that I do lay a lot of this blame as to why so many LGBT people are on the left at the feet of a lot of the Republicans and a lot of people on the Christian mm-hmm. right, because they ignored people like myself. They ignored people who just wanted to have their rights respected back in the day. And I'm talking way before any of this bakery bullshit that you know I can't stand, you know, but way before any of that happened, there were people who just wanted to be respected in terms of their rights. They just wanted their rights respected. They didn't want to be infringed upon. They didn't want to have their businesses looted and searched unlawfully by police officers. They didn't want their ways of making love, you know, to be illegal. You know, and the right, the Christian right, rejected LGBT people. If you were gay, they didn't care. And I know personal stories of people who were active members either in their churches or in social conservative circles or in Republican circles who unfortunately were asked to either step down or were removed when it was found out that they were gay. So I do lay a lot of this blame on people, right? Because the message of liberty got lost. The message of individual rights, of self-determination, that message got lost. And every gay person in this country that sought that answer, that looked for that answer, did not find it with the Republican Party. And so many of them went to the Democratic Party thinking that the Democrats were going to fight for them. And instead, they have a Democratic Party that doesn't give a fuck about them, not in the name of Islam. They are not going to defend LGBT people from Islam. And now this is another part of the result. It's not just the views that the people at the club held. It is a final culmination, in my view, of a lot of horrible things that have happened in the social and cultural and political arena in regards to LGBT people.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah.
There's something.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. And there's something that you said that I want to focus in on. And Daniel, I think we can wrap in the other story at this point. And what you talked about is you said the message of liberty got lost in the conservative movement. And then people moved towards the left and Democrats. And the Democrats did not give a fuck about them. And the other story we have here that I really wanted to include because I think it's really important to acknowledge here, because I think at the top of the show, Daniel, was it you who talked about, is this enabling people or is this making people this violent? That kind of idea, was it you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think part of what's going on here is it's enabling the worst of the worst. And what I mean by that is if this guy, this piece of shit, didn't have a religion telling him that this was the right thing to do, his general sense of life or his psychology or whatever we want to call it might not have been enabled to the point that he felt like he could do this, in the same way that the guy who shot the two reporters was enabled in a way too, because he had the same sort of psychology and sense of life. So do you want to sort of tell the audience about what this other story is that I'm referring to?
Well, actually, I'd like you to do it, if only because there's a lot in this story, and I think there was a certain... We're doing a ton of teasing here, which is not unusual for this show, but...
We're just trying to be more like women. We love women. We're trying to break the patriarchy down by teasing more.
That's right. the original sort of use of this article was more about maybe bias in the sciences and sort of the farcical nature of this, but it takes on a completely different tone in regard to this, and I just want to make sure that you get what you want to convey out of this article.
Okay, well, it's the epic correction of the decade is what it's called. And the correction is, and you might have to correct my correction because I'm not the news guy, so I don't do this as well as you. The correction is basically there was a story that said certain characteristics were characteristic of conservatives. See, I'm not fucking, look how good or bad I am at the news. Are characteristic of the right wing and not the left. But what they actually found out was they got the study exactly backwards. And one of those characteristics was psychotism. So psychotism was supposedly characteristic of the right, when really it's characteristic of people on the left. Now, I was like, what the fuck does psychotism
Isn't
mean?
Isn't it psychoticism? Psychoticism?
I don't psychotism, know. Yeah.
Psychoticism.
I'm going to say fucking psychotism, okay?
I think it's psychoticism. Not to be confused with catechism, which is when they indoctrinate you into Christianity.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
No, that's fine. That's a funny joke. Not to be confused with cataclysm. Yeah. So,
catechism, which is a cataclysm of the mind.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
Oh, the puns. Oh. There are good puns and there are bad puns. Why has God abandoned us?
Because we abandoned God.
God is dead. So it's psychoticism.
Okay.
Psychoticism.
Psychoticism. Whatever the fucking word is, the definition matters more.
Right.
So I went to Wikipedia, and apparently James chastises us if we use Wikipedia. I wasn't aware of that, but...
No. Wikipedia is great.
Yeah, okay. See? All right.
No, I do not chastise. Chastise means to flail your penis around, right?
Oh, well, I chastise all the time when I'm allowed, but, you know, fucking
I don't
feminist.
Chastise you when you use Wikipedia, is what I'm saying.
All right, so this is what psychotism refers to, according to Wikipedia. A personality pattern typified by aggressiveness and interpersonal hostility. Now, to me, it makes much more sense on a specious level that that's associated with the left. Say what you will about the right, and once again, this goes back to me defending Christianity again. Say what you will about the right, but they generally want to leave people alone. But what is... I'm making a comparison here. Compared to the left, who, what do they want? Fucking socialism. Fucking communism, right? Because they believe... Look, why do they believe capitalism is bad? Because they don't believe that anyone with power selling stuff to people is going to sell it fairly. They assume other people are going to try to dick people over. It's the old, when they ask you a question, it's more revealing to of their own psychology than yours. Oh, so you wouldn't save someone starving on the side of the road? No, I never said that. You're saying that, which reveals you're that way. So when they say, you know, oh, well, big business is evil because they're trying to screw people over... That means, no, they're trying to screw people over. So these people live with this concept that interacting is this hostile thing. And then when you have something like radical Islam come in, to fold it in the episode, it enables people like this. This guy who did this had a fucking 3-year-old kid. He was divorced because he abused his wife. You've got a 3-year-old kid and you fucking kill people and die? You abuse your ex-wife and then you remarry? That's somebody who's got fucking issues to begin with seeing relationships not as a traitor principle, as working with a partner. You're gonna fucking leave your 3-year-old kid? Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, so one sort of angle to think about this is something that Adam has brought up a lot, which is like...
Adam Carolla.
Are there certain cultures that perpetuate on their members almost like mass trauma? Like, are there ideologies, whether it be it Islam or leftism, or, you know, bring in any other religion you want to, are there certain cultures that cause mass trauma for the people that follow them, or is it people with trauma are attracted to those religions, or is it some degree of both?
I'm going
to
tell you right now,
it's both, and it's a self-perpetuating cycle that's done completely on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to fucking...
Religion will set up rules like don't masturbate and don't have fun and don't do things that are for your own life, and when you do, you should feel guilty. They set up these rules so that they can be broken. Because once Ellsworth you break them, you lose your self-esteem. And then once you lose your self-esteem, you stop thinking for yourself and you're more likely to accept their bullshit ideas. It's a completely...
That's Ellsworth Chewy.
What's that?
Yeah.
Ellsworth Chewy, that's exactly what
exactly. It's just, it's a completely Ellsworth Chewy type cycle. It is right. On purpose.
Right, and James,
why
I agree...
Why whip a man when you can get him to bring the whip to you?
Right. And I agree with you completely, James. I was only illustrating the difference between the right and the left as an issue of degrees just to make a point.
Yeah.
I mean, I know why you had your trepidation there, because the right is looking to do it in certain ways as well. But I don't think the right sees things as interpersonally hostile as the left does, and that's the point I'm making. And you want to talk about fucking trauma, Daniel? Let's get goddamn personal about this. You and James especially know me, and you know my fucking issues. You want to know where my fucking issues come from? You know, we can talk about my family shit all day. But why don't we talk about the fact that I grew up in the land of the fucking Kennedys, Blue State America, where I had this feminist shit shoved down my throat. You know, they fucking made me deep throat this bullshit while I was in high school. I grew up with this shit. So I grew up with the idea that, you know, fucking women are going to be mad at me for hitting on them, for talking to them. Where in one of my first therapy sessions, my therapist was like, well, why don't we walk through how you would react if a woman reacted that way to you? And then fucking every woman I've approached in real life since has actually been thankful I approached her. But no, I was raised on this idea. I would legitimately say I was traumatized by this bullshit. This idea that there's this hostility between people when they interact. And you have to always assume that people are going to be mad at you and be careful about that. Yeah, I would say firsthand, does it traumatize people? Yes, I would say it does traumatize people. And I think I am living proof of that. I think my issues are living proof of that.
Although Feminist Deep Throat is a great band name. I do want to put that out there.
Yeah.
That's very important. But what you're talking about makes me actually think that there's like this, that the microaggression culture is sort of a lot older than we expect. And it's, I mean, the naming it microaggression is just sort of a modern naming of the issue. Whereas I think you're right that the left, especially like what Ayn Rand labeled as the new left, the egalitarian left, has been basically operating on the principle that all interaction is initiation of violence for a long time, whether be it persuasion, hitting on someone, staring for too long. Basically, all interaction between human beings is necessarily violent and therefore has to be controlled.
Yeah, I mean, to butt in here again, yeah, I was raised on that idea that I was worried if I looked at a girl too long, she would be upset with me, that if I made eye contact. So I would make eye contact with girls and then look away. And on the converse side, it created this perception in my mind that, you know, microaggressions were what turned them off. Well, at the same time, I needed micro assertion to know it was okay to talk to them. So I needed some sort of micro signal to know they wanted me to approach them and I had permission to approach them, which, of course, isn't fucking possible. So I fucking went into a shell where I didn't fucking do anything because I was like, oh, well, I'm not getting any micro permission or micro assertion. So, they must not be interested in me.
And you certainly weren't fucking.
Yes.
That's for sure.
But just only I was being fucked by feminism is what I was.
Yes.
Deep-throating it.
Bend over and pegged by feminism. Absolutely.
I agree. Although, of course, I have many of my reservations with the right, I do agree that, in general, the left is much more intellectually dishonest. The right, here's what I notice, the difference between the right and the left. The right is wrong on a lot of issues, but they tend to, even on the issues they're wrong on, they tend to have actually fairly well thought out arguments. They're still wrong, but they have arguments. If you look at the debate between the left and the right on a lot of these points, you'll notice that the left has these certain points. For example, gun control. That's relevant to today's gun control. They'll say, hey, this violent thing happened, let's make guns illegal. So, you know, very naive, simple logic there. Then the Republicans come back with a very common sense counter argument, which is, hey, if you make them illegal, you're only taking them away from the law abiding citizens who aren't going to use them violently to begin with. So only the criminals will end up having them. Not the most philosophically deep argument, but a perfectly rational one. Is it just me, or does the left never have argumentation against the right's counter-arguments such as these? Is it just me, or do they just simply never bother addressing claims like this? They just keep repeating, we need to get these guns off the streets. We need to get these, and any kind of counter-argument is simply ignored.
Because of the premise... Go ahead.
They treat their argument as if it's self-evident. And that's that's why they won't even attempt it. They're at the point now, and I'm seeing this even on my Facebook feed. They simply will not engage any discussion, and they take it. They're morally indignant if you challenge them on a statement like this. I mean, and all I can think of when I hear that gun control argument is, if there had been one law-abiding person with a gun in that club, just one, how many lives could have been saved? But that argument does not resonate. And it is, and again, it's with other, there are even other gay people, some who were there, who managed to survive, who are making the same argument. It's absurd. But you can't argue with them because they're just not going to listen to you.
Michael Yiannopoulos is calling for the gays to arm themselves, by the way.
Good.
His argument.
I want a gay army led by Milo. That's what I want.
Yeah, dude, we should call it the Companions.
Ah, I love it. Fucking love it. No, this goes back to the
Milo and his companions. And he's Greek too. He's got a Greek last name.
It's like the new
he should just change his last name. He should just Alexander Yiannopoulos. There we go.
Those philosophers and boy lovers. No, James, the reason they don't respond and the reason they take it as a given is it goes back to the interpersonal hostility thing on two levels, where one, it's like, oh, you fucking disagree with me? You fucking piece of shit. You don't deserve to argue with me. My point's self-evident. Why would you do that? Yeah. I'm obviously right. So they come at it aggressively. It's not like, hey, let's exchange ideas and, you know, work for the betterment of our society. It's just, I'm fucking right and fuck you. And then the second thing is, they assume anyone who has a gun is going to use it for bad reasons. The only person who would assume that is someone who would use a gun for bad reasons. Do you get what I'm saying?
I don't know about that, but I agree with the idea that their ideologies cater to their interpersonal hostility. Like, what it does is, especially the ideology of victimization, that they are so focused on their victimhood and how they need reparation, either literally or spiritually. They need this reparation. It plays into the hands of their insecurities, because now this ideology literally feeds right into, like, wait, why does my life suck? Why am I a crazy motherfucker who can't reason? Why is my life in shambles? Oh, it's the white man. It's men. It's capitalism. Whatever. There's this ready-made rationalization. And by the way, you know, we have our own ways in which we, you know, as objectivists and, you know, and as midsiders, that we know that we've been victimized, as you were saying, that you've been victimized by liberal culture. There's
Hold on. I never said I was a victim.
No. Dude, I'm not saying you're doing this. I'm just saying there's a danger.
Just be clear.
To watch out for this, too.
I'm just saying
I'm not saying that I see any evidence that you're victimizing yourself and making excuses or anything. I'm just saying this is something we have to watch out for, too. The biggest benefit of identifying an error in an evil philosophy is so that you yourself do not repeat it, because it's surprisingly easy to do.
You're making me use the fucking whiteboard here, James.
So from a rhetorical perspective, you guys have talked to philosophical side, but I think there is a rhetorical point here to be made, which is that the left is continuing to go toward the sort of morally settled argument route because it has been radically successful with global warming. The left has become a master now of just basically saying there is no argument. You can't argue this. It is base fact. And argumentation of it will not be tolerated, because any argumentation of it means you're ignorant or a bigot or whatever it is. And it's worked radically well with global warming. So it makes complete sense from a rhetorical perspective that they would take this tactic and apply it to any number of things. And the one on gun control is becoming the next really self-evident one.
Isn't that a Saul Alinsky tactic?
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. You just basically have to claim that your argument is not an argument, but is in fact fact.
Right, and just keep repeating
it over and over and over again.
Why
you don't
has
have
this
to
worked?
Have a counter argument.
Why has this worked, Daniel? And I feel like, you know, in past cultures, I would like to think that this is a tactic that would never have worked. You would have been laughed out of Dodge. Why has this worked?
I agree
with you that it's worked. Yeah. I can't see how.
Go ahead, Daniel. And Daniel, if I disagree with your theory, I'll give my theory.
Okay, well, my theory is very general and very broad, so I'm not sure you could possibly disagree with it because it's completely...
I could disagree with it because you're an asshole, you interpersonally hostile person.
Which is
notice
basically...
Notice you use the word person, which is gender neutral.
Which is basically we can't think anymore. And we've stopped being able to critically think because the schools don't teach critical thinking anymore. They teach obedience. And who could you be obedient to outside of the school system but the majority? Well, this is clearly what people believe, so I have to believe this thing. It's once you create an echo chamber where you repeat the same thing over and over again, and you're talking to an audience who is merely looking for the loudest voice or the most voices in a given room, you're necessarily going to win. So they're winning on both sides.
Can I respond to that before you give your versions, Justin?
Yes.
I just have to ask the question. I have to ask this, though. Like, I want to agree with you, but I don't know. Here's the deal. I see people screaming that they want to be that they want to make up their own minds, that they want to be independent, that they want to be nonconformists. How could you say what you just said when this idea of going against the grain is so popular in our culture?
I got the answer.
All right, well, let Justin split the middle here.
Yeah, actually, it's perfect that you went second, James, because I'm going to split the middle. Because what it comes down to is a lack of self-esteem. Ultimately, they do want that, James. That's the American ethos, rugged individualism. I'm cool. I'm on my own. That's James Dean, you know? That's, you know, kind
Jack
of James.
Jack Bauer.
It's what? Jack Bauer?
Yeah.
Jack
yes.
Bauer, baby.
He's always on his own.
Right, yeah. Jack Bauer, exactly.
Never peeing, always on his own.
That's the American ideal is to not pee.
That's right.
You know, it's even James Franco trades in this, right? You know, he's the only one who can write an article about why the selfie is cool because he's so individualistic. So people want that. But if you teach them to be obedient and you teach them not to think for themselves, they have no self-esteem. So ultimately what happens is they try to think on their own and they go, oh, well, this is what I believe. And then they're confronted with they're in a room and there are 50 people who disagree with them. And, you know, they have no self-esteem, but they believe something different. And then 50 people confront them and they go, well, fuck, I must be wrong then. Because if that many people disagree with me and I know this is what happens, because I'm going to be completely honest. I've had moments like that in my life where I fucking go. This is what I talked about this on the Man of Steel episode of the Snyder series. I watch the movie. I love it. Then I read what everyone says and I go, well, fuck, if this many people disagree with it, like, are you, what? And then I watch it again and I go, this is fucking brilliant. And then I read it again and I go, what? And it wasn't until I just was able to, you know, through the coaching of Daniel to be like, ah, fuck them. They're idiots. Like, it takes an insane amount of self-esteem to go against the majority in that way, especially when you have a country that's, you know, built on the ethos of democracy. So it's individualism, but it's also, on the other hand, oh, majority rules. So, you know, that's just, you know, from a psychological standpoint, it's tough to go against the majority. And then you teach these kids obedience and low self-esteem, and they doubt their own minds.
So we have, in effect, a culture of Holden Caulfield, where everyone is trying to be an individualist, but they just simply don't have the balls to do it. So
why do you think everyone loves that fucking god-awful piece of shit book?
I know,
that
right?
book is awful, but they read it.
I mean, I hated it, but on some level, I'm like, I could really see why people love this book. It speaks to them.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
No, it absolutely does. So to add one shade of nuance to that discussion, this is
fuck
anecdotal...
Nuance.
This is anecdotal, so take it for what it is. But, you know, so I have sort of an inverse converse. I always forget the square of opposition, how to actually use that.
Converse is shoes. Converse is shoes.
Oh, well, it's not that. Situation where I'm just one-on-one with someone, and we'll have a long, long discussion about something, and let's use global warming because that's what we brought up earlier. and I'll have sort of rational points to refute everything. The sort of ethos is going well. I'm someone they trust. And the end of the argument, every single time, I can think of at least six clear cases where this happened in each one of them. The end of the conversation is always this, which is, I just don't know. So many people believe the opposite of what you're saying. And that's the final argument. And they leave, and a year later, 2 years later, they absolutely still believe in global warming.
I fucking love when you give me evidence.
Not believe in global warming, but, you know, what I mean, like, we should do something about it or whatever, the rational side of it.
Fucking shit.
And that's always the last argument, and it's always the last vanguard, and there's nothing I can do about it, and it's the ultimate convincing thing for them. But so many people believe it.
I mean, just whenever anyone fucking says that, just be like, everyone believed the world was flat once.
I try that. It's not effective, just to be honest. It's just not effective.
I know it's not effective, but it's just...
I mean, it sounds to me like it's not even an issue of, like, interfacing and convincing a rational mind through a set of logical connections. It's almost like you have to launch into a therapy session with them so that they can regain their rationality on the issue.
Yeah, James, welcome to my life.
And then you can convince.
Absolutely.
Well, welcome to my fucking life. This is why growing up, so many people, it became like Justin is their therapist and became their friend that they gave all their problems to. Because, like, I was more rational growing up, even though I had my own fucking issues. But I was always very good at putting my issues aside and understanding other people's issues and explaining it to them for exactly the reason you just said. To a large extent, the way to get through to people is therapy. It's not all, you know, we love talking about philosophy and, you know, how to fix it that way, but a lot of it is mental health. Fixing it is going to fix this culture.
Well, yeah, the philosophy isn't going to help a damn bit until the therapy is there, until you can actually interface with the issue rationally. Because what everyone knows they're supposed to be independent-minded and shit, but they just don't have the balls to fucking do it.
This is my favorite episode ever.
So
we should just call this the Rage Edition.
No, it's the Interpersonal Hostility Edition.
I agree. Basically,
Is there any other point to the gun control stuff we want to get at? That's sort of the, you know, on top of Islam, that's the second most debated thing.
Guns don't kill people. People kill people. You take away guns, they'll use knives.
Yeah. I want to say something about it, and which is that even if that were not true, even if it were not true that in having more legal gun ownership decreases gun violence, which is true, but even if it weren't true, on a basic moral premise, the principle of self-defense, the protection of ourselves and of our property, because our bodies, our lives, and our property, those are values. Even if it were not true that gun ownership, legal gun ownership, decreases violence, I would still fight for that right. Because it is a basic moral right, the right of self-defense, a protection of your values, protection of yourself. So even if people cannot listen to point-by-point rational arguments, most of them cannot do it because they can't think in principle, which goes into what you're saying about therapy and philosophy. They can't think in moral principles. How can you reach someone who isn't going to think along those lines? The principles at play are opposed.
Yeah, that's a great philosophical point. James, I want you to speak specifically to this point, which is, let's say there's a leftist out there who agrees with Eliot in principle. Not sure we could find one, but maybe. But says, that's all true, but why AR-15s? Why can't we just, like, you can have a handgun, whatever, but why do you need an AR-15? For self-defense.
I mean, this is actually this question is why I actually don't advocate for the Second Amendment on the grounds of self-defense. I take a very, you could call this sort of like a libertarian stance, and I believe the Second Amendment is a right not because of any sort of right to self-defense, but rather because you have the right to own things. You have the right to anything. You have the right to do whatever you want as long as what you're doing does not constitute a threat to someone else. Therefore, I think you should be allowed to own a howitzer if you live out in the country. I think absolutely. If you live out in the country, you should be able to own a rocket launcher, because the use of that rocket launcher does not involve putting anyone else at risk. If you live in a city, no rocket launchers. You can't use the fucking rocket launcher in the city without putting other people at risk. And so they're arguing. So it's not. I just basically, the Second Amendment is not based on. I don't think it's based on self. Everything you're saying is right, Elliot. And like, it would be a moral crime against self-defense to take all guns away. But when it comes to the AR-15, yeah, it's hard to make a self-defense argument for it. The AR-15.
I don't know.
A lot of circumstances isn't. I know what you were saying, Daniel, on how the AR-15 is so much easier to use, but
yeah,
generally pistols are more practical for self-defense.
But I couldn't hit a fucking barrel.
There's certain, what's that?
I couldn't hit a barrel with a pistol.
Yeah, like, pistols are very hard to use.
30
yeah.
times and I missed a barrel.
Yeah, right. But think about it this way, Daniel. Like, you're in tight corners. You're trying to point a rifle, like, inside doors and stuff. A pistol's better for that. You can't care. Also, you cannot conceal carry a rifle.
I just think you're a pussy, yeah. Daniel.
I mean, but the thing is, you're right, Daniel. You're right. I mean, like, so the AR, you know, the semi-automatic rifle is better for self-defense in many situations. But fundamentally, I don't think, I think what sort of supersedes the right of self-defense is the right that you, to your life and your property. You can have whatever the fuck you want as long as it doesn't constitute a threat to others. Can a citizen have a nuclear bomb? No, because you can't use it without putting other people at risk, obviously. Unless you owned the state of New Mexico or something, and you were the only dude who lived there. You know, then sure, have a fucking nuclear bomb. But like, you know... If you owned your own island, then you could have a nuclear bomb? I guess, maybe. But these are still, you know, these are sort of... In principle, you know, it's just... And this is where I think certain gun laws are completely reasonable. We should give people an accuracy test and a safety test before allowing them to have a concealed carry permit. I think that is eminently reasonable. You have to prove that you're not putting people you have to prove that you're not putting people at risk by carrying that gun around. You have
we make them fucking take a driving test before we give them 1,000-pound killing machines.
Absolutely. And so to me, it's the reason you're allowed to have an AR-15 is this is America, and you are allowed to have any fucking thing you want as long as it doesn't constitute a threat to others.
So I have a couple points here. One is just a funny point that I always like to respond with when I'm being glib and not trying to convince people, which is like when people say, why an AR-15? And I'd be like, next you're going to ask Rosa, why the front of the bus? Because it's my fucking right.
I feel very microaggressed right now.
It gives me endless amusement every time I use that on someone. I don't...
Somebody needs to draw a cartoon now, and I would draw it on the whiteboard if I was an artist, of Rosa Parks in the front of the bus holding an AR-15.
That would be excellent, actually.
That would be the cover of
excellent.
Get that to Bosch Fosten, that idea.
That's excellent commentary. But my second thing is, James, which is, so how do you so a lot of things in politics are, the difficult part comes in how do you write a policy to match the principle? So what are the policy lines that you think are rational to draw around gun ownership? You said accuracy test and something else, but it's like...
Well, not for gun ownership. I would say the right to carry the gun wherever you want, I think you should have a safety and accuracy test, because someone carrying the gun around in public is a threat to other people if they don't know what the hell they're doing.
Except I'm going to ask a question.
That's rational.
Aren't you just making them better killing machines if you're making them have an accuracy test?
No, the idea is like, you know, we've done a background check on you. We have no reason to think that you're a psycho killer. And, you know, we have this thing called innocent until proven guilty in this country. You know, if we find no evidence that you're a psycho killer, you have the right to carry the gun around, you know. And so we give an accuracy test to make sure that if you do have to use the gun, you're not going to be capping civilians behind the target. You're going to be hitting the piece of shit who's trying to mow down the gay people.
Because I think, so I asked this question because I don't know, maybe I'm a statist, because I think
this is a valid question, though. I really want to hear this. Yeah.
Because I think on a policy level, I would draw the line in a different way. It's like I understand about the right of ownership, but I think that a rocket launcher, in a lot of contexts, is an existential threat to people. Like,
I agree.
Maybe
there would have to be some regulations, but they would be based on the idea of, are you or are you not a threat to other people by owning it? It depends on the context. In New York, no rocket launchers.
Yeah, and I'm
country. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Just as someone who lived out in the country, but I don't know. A lot of rednecks in the country, getting real bored.
Moving to the country, gonna shoot us a lot of rockets. Moving to the country.
And certainly, my policy position basically outlaws howitzers. And maybe I am a statist, but no howitzers for people. Absolutely.
I think you're using common sense instead of principle there. You're just basically saying, no, that's just too big. That's just too much.
That's what she said. I don't know where you could own a howitzer where it wouldn't be a threat.
I mean, yeah, you would definitely have to, you know, maybe there's a place where there's a howitzer range and, you know, and you are and you're allowed to own it as long as, you know, there's a range there and you can show, hey, I'm going to go to that range. We're going to set up little, you know, cardboard tanks and we're going to blow them up with our howitzer.
I mean, maybe.
I'm doing this, by the way, once I'm rich, so you better not outlaw this. Don't ruin this for me, Daniel.
There are places in the country where you can go drive a tank. Which I have always found amusing. And fire shit out of the tank. So one other quick question for everyone to go around quickly is, are there any gun laws that you think, two-part question, are there any gun laws we should pass right now, either in response to this or just because we should? And two, would any of those laws, do you think, have prevented what happened in Orlando? Because this is another issue being debated. When the Obama says we need comprehensive gun reform, and everyone just goes, okay, well, what do you mean by that specifically? And there is no answer. So I'm asking you, what would that be if there should be any? And would it have prevented what happened in Orlando?
No and no. No, no new gun laws, and if there were, it wouldn't do a damn thing.
Justin Elliott, any different response?
Well, Elliott's not here right now, so hopefully he comes back. But I would just simply fucking say you can't argue counterfactuals. You don't know what the fuck would happen if reality were different, so I'm not even going to dignify any of those fucking arguments with a response, because all that's doing is granting validity to that fucking little mind experiment. Like, well, what if LeBron James had Steph Curry on his team? He doesn't have him on his fucking team. Fuck off. I'm not going to dignify that as if somehow that makes LeBron James a better player, makes Peyton Manning a better player. Same thing here. Well, what if these laws were in place so, you know, this wouldn't have happened? Fuck you. They weren't in place. This happened. I'm not going to dignify and give you some fucking moral high ground on your argument. You're going to try and trap me with contradicting reality. No, that's fucking bullshit.
All right.
One thing I will say is that this guy was being watched. This piece of shit was being watched by the FBI.
Yes.
And they watched him for a number of years. They stopped watching him, and that's why he was eventually able to purchase a gun without raising any red flags, which is very surprising to me. But, I mean, if you're investigating someone, then you no longer have suspicion in that person. Yeah, they have the right to buy a gun again. But I think this goes to show that, you know, we should not be trying to track down individual motherfuckers in this country. We should be striking back against the heart of the enemy, which means, you know, military action against the heart of the Islamic philosophy.
All right, couple last routes we could take with this discussion, depending on what is of most interest to you two. So one is asking, you know, the follow-up to what James just said, which is, what is a rational response? What should we be doing to fight Islamic extremism? What does that look like? Or we could talk about the more contemporary, not contemporary, sorry, the more sort of political, like how does this affect the election? Is this something that helps Trump? Is it something that should help Trump? Are we now considering Trump a more likely candidate because of his foreign policy stance? He just came out today and basically said that this ignorance must stop. So what route do you want to go down?
I think we can fold these into both. So why don't we just go around and each answer these questions, and that'll sort of be like the cap on the episode. Because we can even say ourselves if this is making us personally support Trump more. How's that sound?
That sounds good. So let's start with James, because I know that James is very passionate about the militaristic response. And I want to know what kind of militaristic response he thinks, at least in principle, is what we should be doing.
I mean, I'm not a, you know, military strategist, but the idea, I think, is, you know, hit something big like the Kaaba. Tell them, like, okay, we're going to destroy the Kaaba in 24 hours. You have 24 hours to evacuate the area. Fundamentally tell this ideology, like, no, we do not recognize your ideology. We are at war with your ideology, and you must surrender. You must submit to us just like you submit to Allah. And then we will leave you alone. We're not going to fucking be your masters or anything, but you must submit to our right to exist. And that means as much military action as is required. A lot of people tell me, you know, James, you play with airsoft guns, but, you know, you're a coward. You're not willing to go to war yourself. Of course I'm not willing to go to war myself. This is what drones, guided missiles, and fusion weapons are for. Civilized people do not need to be physically brave to defend themselves. They just have to be morally brave. We have to understand that the innocent people, and there will be innocent people killed, the innocent people killed in a fusion attack are on the hands of the aggressors, not on the hands of us. What's the alternative? We die? No, we have to strike back. We have to defend ourselves through extreme measures, including fusion weapons. And that means that innocent people will die, and it is completely the fault of the aggressor. We need to have moral bravery, or else we're going to continue sacrificing men who have to, you know, demonstrate physical bravery.
So, Trump 2016, then?
Trump, fuck Trump. It's just, Trump is going to be, Trump talks a big fight. He's not going to be any better than any of the rest of them. That's a little flippant and maybe a little inaccurate, but I think it's essentially true. It's essentially what I think will happen. And Trump is a negotiator, not a principled thinker. He will be unable to wield the force necessary to defend us.
I'll go, because I don't have a ton to add to what James said. I would say just a sort of a rephrasing of what James said is that there's a great book called Nothing Less Than Victory, which sort of chronicles how great civilizations have triumphed in war and have lost in war. And I think the demonstrated only way that you triumph in war is to make it so that there is no path to victory for your enemies, and they see it as clear as day, that there is nothing they can do to win their fight, that it is utterly hopeless, and that they understand that out of that hopelessness will come nothing but death and despair for them. That is how we did it in World War II with the Germans and the Japanese. And the Japanese, there are so many comparisons to the Japanese imperialistic ideology and the modern iteration of Islam that it's frightening. And you just have to make it so that there is absolutely, unequivocally, very clear, no path to victory for them, that they will die. And all of them will die, if necessary, in pursuit of this, so that we have the right to live. I don't think it would ever come to that, obviously. I think they would submit before that. I think if the West showed a modicum of backbone, a modicum of military might in a region of the world that is primarily in the fucking Stone Age, but this would not be a 50-year campaign. This could be a 2-year campaign where the Muslim world, which, by the way, in its history has had great periods of enlightenment and rationality, would say, gotcha, we're not going to do that. And maybe we have to do that every century. Maybe we have to come around every century and bomb the fuck out of people who want to kill us. But let's resolve to do that and not be, as to use Justin's parlance, fucking pussies about it.
Look, we've got a huge fucking dick. We've got the biggest dick. So all we gotta do is show
the
them
smallest
like
balls.
We gotta show right, exactly. Which, you know, no woman wants. Like, if you pull out a big dick with small balls, they're just like, what the fuck? Like,
they're like, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm out. This is gross. Like, but no, seriously, dude, just show them half of the dick. Show them half of the dick, and they'll be like, "Ah, fuck, you win. You have the bigger dick. Take our virgins. Take our 72 virgins."
Ew. Yeah, I don't think it would take all that much to be successful, honestly. I mean, what I mean is in the scale of things, it would take a lot in terms of military ramp up and moral fortitude, but it would not, this is not a decades long campaign to fight this. I mean, it's really not.
I think I want to add another point to that too, by the way. Because we're talking about foreign policy and stuff and what the military should do and what government should do, but I want to add a point about the culture, what the people need to do. We have got to wake up. We have got to wake up to what is going on in this world. I go back to some of these gay men that were at Pulse, and how many of them signed petitions saying gays for Palestine or gays stand with Palestinians again, and how many of them participated in anti-Israeli campaigns? We have got to wake up here culturally, because there's really not much we can do militarily and politically if we don't do something culturally among us, among the people. We need to wake up to the threat of Islam. We need to wake up to the fact that there are people in power in this country that don't actually care about whatever group you subscribe to, because they just want to remain in power, and they're not going to defend you against jihad. They are not going to defend you against these bloodthirsty monsters, because they just want to be in power.
Justin, you want to wrap that up?
Yeah, I'll just put a bow on the episode here, and then you can go right into plugging Daniel. So to kind of add everything you guys said, throw it in a pot, stir it together, and have it come out a mid-side formula here. I'm turning around the whiteboard here on the Welcome to the Metaside video, and it says, "This is Sparta." We all need to fucking watch 300 and realize the fucking point that movie's making and kick the shit out of them. And you know what? That might make a lot of people vote for Donald Trump. I don't think I personally would vote for Donald Trump, but I do think that this may, it's definitely going to help him more than it'll help Hillary, and this may be what propels him to be president. I don't know, but would I personally vote for him? No, but I do think everyone needs to fucking watch 300. That's what I think needs to happen.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was one of the most intense episodes of the Midside that I've ever been a part of in my tenure.
No mentions of Tom Brady. Can you believe it?
I was just going to say, second only to the Deflategate episode. You fucking
idiot.
Dude, we blew our load early, man. Come on. Also, notice intensity increased the number of dick references.
It's true.
It's true.
It's true. That's how we work here at the Midside. So if you, you know, there was a lot.
You
said.
Want more dick references.
If you want more dick references, you can
call me at 508.
themidside.com/podcast. Look, we understand there was a lot said here today, and the Midside is nothing else. It is a forum for people to yell profanity at each other. So please, if you disagreed with us, or if you agreed with us, but you thought we didn't say that you would fucking have said it, then tell us. Go to twitter.com/themidside, leave us some hate mail. Go to facebook.com/themidside, leave us a giant middle finger picture, or a dick pic, whatever you want. We'll take anything at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to snap any of that at us too, just do the Midside on Snapchat.
On the Snapchat. And then, of course, Justin mentioned Welcome to the Metaside. That's our new YouTube offering. You can watch Justin record the show. That's right. You can watch him do a podcast. Isn't that fucking riveting?
It's so Deadpool. Welcome to 2016, motherfuckers.
That's right. Commentary about the podcast he's doing live. That's how fucking meta we are here at the Midside. And then, of course, Patreon.com/themidside.
Oh,
we have people.
Patreon.
All hail the great Patreon. We have people who give us money to do this. Can you believe, I mean, maybe not after this episode, but we have people who give us money to say this shit, which is awesome. We love the Patreon subscribers. You too can be a Patreon subscriber. We too can worship at your feet by going to patreon.com/themidside. You can choose to put in a couple bucks per episode, $1 per episode, 10 cents per episode, whatever you want to do. James, what does it help us do?
Keep the lights on.
That's right. Helps us keep the lights on.
And a shout out, Patreon supporters. That helps us develop a relationship with our listeners. In fact, when I am in Austin this weekend for Daniel's nuptials, look at me all fancy with the word nuptials. Nuptials makes me think of like nipples, though.
It does. It's a little sexual.
I will be having lunch with a Patreon supporter of the podcast. So
that's right. You too can pay for Justin's lunch if you.
Yeah, am I obligated to buy him lunch now? Fuck, why did you say that?
I think you are, in fact. So yeah, absolutely. And of course, iTunes, go to iTunes and search for The Midside and give us a 5-star rating, not 1 or 3, but 5. And read all the other great 5-star ratings. And then of course, finally, and above all else, seriously, this is the way the podcast grows the fastest. We know this. Tell someone. Run this podcast on your phone up to someone you know who wants to bomb the shit out of people in the Middle East and be like, oh my God, you have to fucking listen to this. Just tell them and then put the earbuds in their ear very intimately as if you are a close acquaintance, and then stand there and stare in their eyes as they witness, as they reveal the glory that is the Midside.
You should have said as they witness the farce, dude.
Yeah, but whatever.
And then when they're so delirious because they're listening and they're not paying attention, whip out your dick so when they come back to reality, they're just like, what the fuck?
Yeah, so you can chastise them.
I'm Justin M. Wozeski, and I hope you learned something this trip. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a
day! Okay, I have an idea. Elliot, you yeah. say have a, and then I'll say day.
All right, ready?
All right, 1, 2, 3.
Have a?
Day!
What the fuck?
That was excellent.